Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case, two cases this morning, 2020-773, Harry Fonzi III and Linda Grimes versus Gary D. Brown and Eclipse Resource, and 2020-861, Harry A. Fonzi III and Linda Grimes versus Alan B. Miller, Craig Miller, Brenda Thomas, and Eclipse Resource. For the appellant, Mr. Corcoran.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Dan Corcoran, and I am counsel for the landowners in these cases, the Millers and the Browns. And I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. Because my time is limited, I'm not going to rehash the facts that are laid out in full within the briefs. I would like to get straight to the arguments. And just as in the briefs, I would like to start my arguments on proposition of law number 4. The issue presented here is what this court said in Corbin about the meaning of Division B. Our brief asserts that the words deemed abandoned create a conclusive presumption, which is an evidentiary device that can be asserted in a judicial action. That comes directly from this court's holding in Corbin. In Corbin, this court recognized that by creating a conclusive presumption, the legislature provided a method of terminating abandoned mineral rights that could only be asserted through a quiet title action. That's from paragraph 25. We believe this court's reasoning in Corbin should apply equally to the current version of the statute. That's why our brief so strongly embraces that decision. Since that same language is present in the statute today, it should be interpreted and applied the same way. Based on the current version of Division B, a landowner should be allowed to abandon a mineral interest in a judicial action. The appellees try to argue in their brief that allowing that would be something new, but that's not true. As Corbin explained, this method of abandoning a mineral interest in a judicial action has been around since the DMA was first enacted in 1989. Now, I will talk about how this would work under Division B, but before I do that, I want you to consider what the appellee's position here is. They say that a landowner cannot use Division B in a judicial action. In their brief, pages 17 and 18, they say, "Nothing about the concept of a presumption would indicate that litigation must have been intended." Now, that statement from their brief is actually a direct attack on this court's reasoning in Corbin. In Corbin, this court felt that the mere existence of the conclusive presumption was so compelling that a quiet title action was not only possible, it was actually required in order to invoke the statute. And why was it required? Because that's what an evidentiary device is. That is how it works. You cannot have an evidentiary device without also recognizing that there must be a judicial action in which it can be asserted. Now, the statute doesn't expressly say anything about this judicial action. It didn't say anything about it in the 1989 version, and it doesn't say anything about it in the current version of the statute. But nevertheless, that's what this court was addressing in Corbin. Even though it doesn't expressly say that you need to do that, the mere fact that the legislature created this conclusive presumption shows that it was their intent that it must be asserted in judicial action. Now, this is not the way that the statute has been interpreted and applied by the Seventh District. The lower courts, in my opinion, seem to be confused about how Division B operates because when the statute was amended in 2006, the legislature also added a process of abandonment in Divisions E through I that this court has described as an extrajudicial process. The reason it is an extrajudicial process is because when it is completed, it does not require the landowner to go to court. Appellees assert that because the legislature added this extrajudicial process, the landowner can't file a judicial action to have a mineral interest abandoned under Division B anymore. They say the extrajudicial process is the only way to abandon a mineral interest under the statute, and that's what the lower courts have held. Now, the lower courts have admitted numerous times that they're not really following your interpretation of the words deemed abandoned, but they believe they're not required to follow it because Corbin was just a plurality opinion. And it is true that there was a plurality opinion in Corbin, but the central holding in that case, that a an abandonment under Division B must be asserted in a judicial action was joined by a clear majority of four justices. There was a separate concurring opinion by Justice Kennedy, but she agreed with the plurality that Division B required judicial action. She made that clear in her concurring opinion, and she also made it clear in the follow-up majority opinion that she wrote in the Albanese versus Batman case, where in paragraph 18 she cited to Corbin, saying that the words deemed meant the abandonment required judicial action. The reason she wrote separately was because she believed that in the judicial action, the landowner needed to prove not just that there was a lack of savings event, but also that there was intent to abandon. Moreover, and even if we could ignore Corbin, which I don't think we should, but even if we could, a majority of four justices on this court held within just the last year in the case West v. Bode, paragraph 25, that the 2006 DMA uses the same operative language in Division B as the 1989 DMA, and that it likewise creates a conclusive presumption of abandonment. That is exactly our point. And so at this point, there's no basis for the lower courts to continue to disregard this court's holding in Corbin that Division B is supposed to operate within a judicial proceeding. Now let's talk about how Division B actually works. Does it work exactly the same way as the 1989 version? No, it doesn't. Before a landowner can file an action today, there are a couple of additional requirements that have to be satisfied. The first is that the landowner has to serve or publish a notice of intent to abandon, and second, the landowner has to record an affidavit of abandonment. As this court has already recognized in the Albanese versus Batman case, these are mandatory requirements. So if a landowner files a claim under Division B without satisfying these requirements, the case should be dismissed. But in this particular case, our clients have satisfied those requirements. There's no dispute that we recorded the affidavits of abandonment, and before that, we published notices in the newspaper, and I even inserted an image of those notices into our reply briefs. Okay, there's no dispute about whether these were published. There's no dispute about whether the newspaper is a newspaper of general circulation. There's no dispute about whether this notice complies with all the requirements in terms of the information that it must contain. So those are the only two requirements in Division B. After that, you can file a quiet title action and use the evidentiary device to have a mineral interest deemed abandoned if there are no savings events in the relevant 20-year period, which is similar to what you would have done under the 1989 version. Now, what if the mineral holder files a response to the notice by recording a claim to preserve? How should that be handled under Division B? Appellees say that Division B is subject to the notice requirement, and it is true that it's subject to the notice requirement. I just said that. But that doesn't mean that it's subject to the holder's response to the notice. That is something different. And we know that it is not subject to the holder's response because the extrajudicial process that was added actually has three steps for the landowner to follow. We've already talked about the first two. They have to serve or publish the notice, then they have to record the affidavit of abandonment. But then after the landowner has completed those first two steps, Division H says that the landowner is supposed to file another notice if the holder fails to timely respond. This is referred to as the notice of failure to file under Division H2. Now, if you go back and look at Division B and Division E, however, they're not subject to that third step. It is not conditioned on whether the landowner files that third notice of failure to file, and therefore it's not conditioned on whether the holder did or did not file a response of the notice of intent to abandon. Under Division B, a mineral interest can only be preserved if you have a savings event in the 20 years immediately preceding the notice. Any response that the holder files to the notice, which by definition takes place after the notice, it doesn't work. Since the holder's response to the notice doesn't affect the operation of Division B, it doesn't really matter under Division B if the notice should have been mailed or published, or whether the holder was or was not given an opportunity to respond to that. The response simply doesn't matter. Under Division B, the notice is simply there to establish that 20-year look-back period. You have to have the notice in order to do that, and then you need to have the affidavit, because the affidavit puts the fact that the notice was served or published of record. Appellees also suggest that the conclusive presumption in Division B is now somehow part of the extrajudicial process. The problem with that position is that an extrajudicial evidentiary device is a contradiction. Rules of evidence and conclusive presumptions are for judicial proceedings. They have no place in an extrajudicial process. If Division B is treated as being part of the extrajudicial process, then it's not really a conclusive presumption or an evidentiary device anymore. It is no longer something that can be used in litigation. litigation, and it would operate differently. So if you try to merge the conclusive presumption out of existence, then the meaning of the words deemed abandoned fundamentally changes, even though the words are exactly the same. Our position is that the same words should be given the same meaning in both versions of the statute. The creation of an extrajudicial process does not require the elimination of any potential legal action. This is why we spent so much of our brief talking about 5301.332. Just like the extrajudicial process for abandoning a mineral interest under the DMA, it is an extrajudicial process for canceling oil and gas leases. Both are designed to potentially avoid unnecessary litigation. When it comes to the operation of that statute, it has long been recognized that a landowner can still assert a claim for lease termination in a legal action. The creation of the extrajudicial process does not supersede that. It does not supersede a pre-existing right to file a judicial action. So what this statute shows is that even if you have an extrajudicial process available, it doesn't have to be the only way of providing the landowner with a remedy regarding the title to his land. The landowner can still seek the same relief by other means, including through a judicial action. And that happens with the cancellation of oil and gas leases all the time. It can also happen with the abandonment of minerals. Just like 5301.332 does with leases, divisions E through I can coexist with a judicial method of mineral abandonment. It does not need to be the exclusive way of providing a landowner a remedy. Since these two different provisions, the conclusive presumption and the extrajudicial process, can operate independently of each other, that means, yes, there may be circumstances in which an interest may be abandoned under one but not the other. So a mineral holder can prevent an abandonment under the extrajudicial process by timely filing a claim to preserve, but that same holder cannot prevent an abandonment of his interest in a quiet title action under Division B if he cannot show a savings event in the 20 years immediately preceding the notice. That is the situation that we have in this case. There are no savings events here. At the time the notice was published, appellees did not even know about the interest, and their mother had been deceased for more than 20 years. So in a quiet title action under Division B, it doesn't matter whether they responded or would have responded to the notice. It doesn't matter whether the notice should have been mailed or published. Because we're dealing with a claim that has been asserted in a quiet title action under Division B, the nature of the search in this case is not a material issue to whether or not the interest has been abandoned, and the court should have entered judgment in favor of the landowners.
Why is an insufficient search not material or relevant?
Because the holder's response to the notice does not make a difference in terms of whether the interest is abandoned under Division B.
But are you saying that there are two methods to this, or that the statutory and the traditional judicial just perform different functions? Which are you saying?
I'm not sure if I understand your question. I'm saying there are two methods, and you have to, and they kind of overlap, because the first two steps of the extrajudicial process, the notice and the affidavit, are also requirements under Division B, which is where you can assert the conclusive presumption in judicial action. So you always have to take the first two steps. If the landowner is able to accomplish the third step because the holder doesn't respond, then it's abandoned under the extrajudicial process and there's no need for litigation. But if they do file a response, then the landowner can still avail himself of Division B by filing a quiet title action and proving, like we said under proposition of law number 4, we served the notice, we recorded the affidavit, and there's no savings events.
But what if the search suggests that they're in Pennsylvania or could be in Pennsylvania, and there's no effort made to publicize in Pennsylvania, only in Monroe County?
Yes. For purposes of this proposition of law, I don't think that would make any difference. Their response doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether they got it. It doesn't matter whether it should have been mailed or published. Now, the fact that it doesn't matter in this case, though, I'm not saying that it never matters. I'm not saying that it never matters whether you do a search, okay? And this kind of relates to our fifth proposition of law. What we said is that the landowner's diligence in conducting a search is an important issue if the landowner attempts to prevent the former holder from presenting evidence in court based on the evidentiary bar in Division H2, which a landowner can do when the holder fails to timely respond to the notice. Now, in that event, the holder does not lose the right to present evidence in court unless they have been given sufficient notice, properly served.
If you're saying there's two methods, and the one you seem to prefer is the statutory method, that keeps you out of court, right? Unless somebody challenges what you've done.
Well, it would keep you out of court, but we're in court. Okay, right. They sued us. And so we they filed a complaint against us, and we asserted a counterclaim, and we have asserted that we did a diligent search. Okay. We're making arguments with respect to both methods. We're arguing that we did a diligent search, but we're also arguing that even if we didn't do a diligent search, the court should rule that the interest is abandoned anyway under Division B because we satisfy all those requirements.
But how can someone know of a risk if they're never made aware of it?
Are you talking about the mineral holders?
Correct.
Well, they wouldn't. And whether they're made aware of it or not shouldn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference under Division B. Whether they respond to the notice, that's not a condition. That's not a requirement to whether or not the conclusive presumption would apply in a legal action. If you think about it, that's the way the 1989 version of the statute worked. So you didn't have the notice in the affidavit under the 89 version, but the landowner could file a quiet title action. Okay, and they could assert we have no savings events in the relevant 20-year period. Now, does it matter whether the mineral holder responds to that complaint in the legal action and say, oh no, I don't intend to abandon my mineral rights? They can say that if they want to, but it's not going to prevent the abandonment under a conclusive presumption. That's the way it worked under the 1989 version of the statute, and that's the way the conclusive presumption would work here as long as you have satisfied those additional requirements, which we have. So the service of the notice is a material issue only if the landowner is attempting to prevent the mineral holder in a judicial action from presenting evidence. But we're not doing that in this case. They didn't respond to the notice, but we didn't try to say that, oh no, you can't present any evidence in this case of your interest because you didn't respond to it. Instead, the issue should be whether there are any savings events in the 20 years immediately preceding the notice. And those words immediately preceding are right there in Division B. It clearly
didn't respond because they didn't get notice, because even though there was an indication in the title search that the people who originally owned it had moved to Pennsylvania, and that's where these people happen to be.
Yes. And what I'm saying is that if I had sent it to them by certified mail, they had received it, and they had filed a claim to preserve, the court should rule that it's abandoned anyway under Division B.
But you didn't send it to them by certified mail.
We didn't send it.
And you're saying they have to prove that they could have received it by certified mail in order...
I'm saying it doesn't matter whether they would have received it by certified mail. We need the notice only for the purposes of setting the 20-year look-back period. Whether the notice was sent to them by mail or by publication, whether they got it, whether they didn't get it, whether they responded or would have responded, none of those questions matter for purposes of Division B and the conclusive presumption. That's our position.
So your instigation of the abandonment sets the timeline, the beginning, and then you look
notice
back to 20 years and... Apparently, Mr. Fonzi et al. Were not even aware that this existed, that their mother had these rights, and they didn't prove that they inherited them, and they hadn't taken any action. They couldn't take any action because they didn't know they existed.
That's right.
And that's your position. That's
right. And you also talked about this in the West case. Those savings events, what are they? They're supposed to indicate some intent to keep this interest, to preserve this interest. How can you possibly demonstrate that intent if you don't even know about it? That's why there were no savings events in this case. Now, as I said, we're asserting this proposition of law under the conclusive presumption, but we are also asserting that we did a diligent search and it should be abandoned under the extrajudicial process. So even if this court rejects propositions of law 4 and 5, the search is and if you think that the search is material, the Seventh District applied the wrong standard in evaluating that search and in assigning the burden of proof. Under proposition of law number 2, we assert that if appellees wish to challenge whether the interest is abandoned, they should have the burden in that challenge. We say that not just because they filed this case, although they did, we say that because they are the ones who are challenging record title here. Based solely on a review of record title, the mineral interest in this case became vested in my clients back in 2012 and 2013 when that memorialization on the record was made. Division H2 says that immediately upon memorialization of the record, the interest is abandoned, it is vested in the landowner, and the holder becomes a former holder. This means that something is supposed to happen when that third step is completed, which it was in this case, and that change in title is reflected in the records. And we think this court already agrees with that. In West v. Bode, paragraph 26, this court recognized that the DMA establishes the landowner's marketable record title to the minerals upon compliance with the terms of the extrajudicial process. There's not supposed to be any need for further judicial confirmation of that. If there was, it would kind of defeat the whole point. We pointed out in our brief that there should be a presumption of validity on any real property interest that has been accepted by the recorder under 5301.07b1b. That should apply to mineral abandonments. But not only that, keep in mind the DMA is part of the Marketable Title Act, and so it must be interpreted and harmonized with the overall purpose of that statute, which is set forth in 5301.55. That statute says that the purpose of the MTA is to allow persons to rely on a record chain of title. When an interest is abandoned under the DMA's extrajudicial process, it is supposed to give the landowner not just a claim to title, but actual marketable record title. But if the landowner is the one who is required to offer further proof of this title whenever a former holder comes out of the woodwork years later to challenge it, then his title is not really marketable, and neither he nor anyone else dealing with the mineral interest has any ability to rely on the recorded abandonment. This would undermine the purpose of the MTA if the burden is assigned to us. So if a former holder wishes to dispute that a landowner has record title to a mineral interest based on a completed recorded abandonment, the former holder should have the burden of proof. Now, okay, proposition law number three. We're saying is that the former holder needs to demonstrate when challenging a mineral abandonment what they would have found. If you think that we should have searched in Pennsylvania, what would have been found? Now, the 7th District believed that we should have searched there, and it invalidated the mineral abandonment for that reason alone, and it did not make any difference what would have been found in Pennsylvania. The appellees even admit that the court did not take this into consideration. Instead, it simply held that the failure to search in Pennsylvania was unreasonable per se. Now, this court held less than a year ago in Garrity that there are no bright-line rules that apply to landowner searches, and that reasonableness is instead based on the facts and circumstances in each case. The 7th District did not do that here. This is the point. There's nothing in their opinion about whether the appellee's addresses could have been actually discovered based on the facts and circumstances in this case. In Garrity, this court also suggested that what you find, the search results, should matter when addressing the contention about whether or not the landowner should have searched on the internet. This court responded that the record contains no evidence of what an internet search would have revealed. That's in paragraph 34. Therefore, it should matter in this case whether there is any evidence in the record about what a search in Pennsylvania would have revealed in 2012. So even if the 7th District believed that the landowners in this case should have searched in Pennsylvania, it should not have reversed the trial court's judgment unless that failure to search affected the substantial rights of the parties. That is the basic principle of Civil Rule 61. And if additional search efforts would not have made any difference in whether it was published or mailed, then it does not affect substantial rights.
And Counsel, did you want to save 10 minutes, did I hear?
I did, and so maybe I ought to save it for the rebuttal. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Morning, Chief Justice. May it please the court. I'm Mark Fisher for the appellees and plaintiffs. I appreciate the opportunity to present to this court this morning. I want to just start by jumping right into this idea of two methods. I had another introduction, but I'm throwing it away for now. The primary issue here is whether or not there actually are two methods under this 2006 version of ADMA, whether you can not serve notice and whether it matters whether a claim to preserve was filed so long as you go and seek a quiet title and show that there are no savings events. That's the method that's being claimed is still within the statute. And We don't think it is. We think the statute's very clear. We think it's unambiguous, and we think this court's decisions in Dodd, Corbin, and Garrity support our interpretation. And I think a good place to start is the language of the 89 version. And Division B in the 89 version said, I quote, any mineral interest held by any person other than the owner of the surface of the land subject to the interest shall be deemed abandoned and vested in the owner of the surface if none of the following applies. And then there's the list of situations and savings events. That's it. There's no process in the original statute.
Did your clients come up with savings events?
No, there are no savings events within the 20 years. We can see that.
So everybody agrees with that.
Right. So what I'm saying, I think, is that version this court held was not self-executing, and that is why a quiet title action was necessary to effect an abandonment under that. It was held to be not self-executing, and as counsel aptly said, it was a plurality decision, but there were five judges that held that it was not self-executing. Unlike that, this court at Corbin said that the new version specifies the procedure that a surface holder is required to follow in order to have a dormant interest deemed abandoned and merged with the surface. The 2006 version made significant and, in my view, obvious changes to the statute. Now, starting with Division B, instead of just stopping, and as the last one said, saying that there's a deemed abandonment if none of the savings events applies, this new version says that the holder's interest, quote, shall be deemed abandoned and vested if the requirements established in Division E are satisfied and if none of the savings events have occurred. You have to do all of that. You have to satisfy the requirements. And as we, you know, said in our brief, you know, those three words, if, requirements, and satisfied, all have a lot of weight. If means that you can't get abandonment without reference to Division E. There is no Division B abandonment. There is Division B points directly in its language to Division E. And requirements means the mandatory notice requirements. Requirements assumes that those are mandatory. And satisfied means that you actually complete them, whereas counsel is suggesting that you don't have to complete them, that it's irrelevant whether you complete them as long as you go and file a quiet title action. Nothing in the statute suggests that to us, and we don't see any word in the statute, and that's why we said that in our brief. We don't see any language that would suggest that there is this path. Division E then starts with before a mineral interest becomes vested under Division B. So again, there is no quiet title version. Before a mineral interest becomes vested under Division B, the surface owner must do both of the following. And then it lists the notice requirements and the filing of the applicable affidavits. And then, of course, E points to H and the holder's right to file a claim to preserve, which this court has held was conclusive in more than one opinion. And again, I think this court in the three opinions that we referenced make it really clear that this is the process. In Dodd, this court said the General Assembly amended the Dormant Mineral Interest Act by adding a notice procedure that the surface owner must initiate in order to have the mineral rights deemed abandoned. What the Dodd court went on to say, before the mineral interest can be deemed abandoned or vested, can be vested in the surface owner must complete the task required by Division E. And then the Dodd court, of course, went on to say that there is a right to file a claim to preserve, which counsel here is suggesting is irrelevant as long as he files a quiet title action. Again, that was an added protection added by the legislature in the 2006 version. So after the Dodd decision, this court, you know, entered the Corbin decision, which again says the 2006 ADMA, quote, specifies the procedure which the surface holder is required to follow to obtain abandonment. and went on to say, as of June 30, 2006, a surface holder seeking to claim dormant mineral rights and merge them with the surface estate is, quote, required to follow the statutory notice and recording procedures.
Okay. Counsel, if we agree with you that notice of by certified mail return receipt requested to each holder, as is laid out in 5301.56E, tell me why this fails, why that was not accomplished.
Our position is that the Seventh District got it right, that they have an obligation, which is the obligation this court enunciated in Garrity, to do a reasonably diligent search. That, as this court said in Garrity, that, you know, that it's not a bright line case, but if there is information that you either have in your independent knowledge or that you learn in your initial search in the county of record, you're required to follow up on that.
And that was the path that led to the Pennsylvania.
Right. They were identified in both the relevant deeds and in the prior deeds in which they got the property as residing in Washington County, Pennsylvania, and the heirs still live there. The one of the estates is there. Their property records are there. We believe with Washington County's online records, it would have taken like 5 minutes to find out who they were. We think that the Seventh District got it right, and that you have to look, and they didn't look. And, you know, they didn't even make attempt to look. And why, in our mind, why the burden of proof issue doesn't matter is because we're not dealing with disputed facts. We're dealing, the Seventh District's decision is based on unrebutted evidence, an admission of record that they knew of this information. They made a determination that it was not relevant because it was too old. They wouldn't look there. And that's the fact. There is no, in our mind, burden of proof doesn't matter. I mean, we agree with the Seventh District when it comes to the Proposition 3, which is, do you have to show that you would have found? We think the emphasis of the statute is, did the surface owner perform reasonable diligence? If they did a reasonable search, it doesn't matter, if they would have found it or wouldn't have found it. They did a reasonable search. That's the focus of the inquiry. And, I think that gels with the idea that you don't want a surface owner to say, hey, we're not going to do any search, and we're going to file our notice, and if someone challenges it, we can still prove that we wouldn't have found them. You have to do the reasonable search. But in our view, again, that issue doesn't matter. It matters in the scope of this state and, other people that are using the statute. It doesn't matter to us because we believe the evidence that what was in Washington County is abundant on the record, and it was unrebutted, and, we think it's all there. The only response made to that evidence by the defendants in the case is this argument that Mrs. Fonzie was the true holder. She inherited the property. Her husband joined in the sale as a spouse, and the reservation is in both their names. But in our mind, none of that really matters. If you're looking for a holder and the reservation's 50 years old, you're going to look for both of those people because one would be an heir. The husband might lead to the wife if you see a record of the husband. The idea that you would not look for Harry Fonzie is belied by their own searches, as we showed. Their own in the searches they actually did in Monroe County, they looked for Harry Fonzie and Elizabeth Fonzie. So to me, that's a non-starter. They also argue that, she was divorced, and thus we wouldn't have looked under that name. But again, the whole standard in Garrity is, you search based on the information you have. They had no idea that she was divorced. They knew that Mrs. Fonzie reserved it. She was married to Mr. Fonzie. They lived in Washington County. That would have led them to his estate, to the only heirs, to my clients. And I think going back to our argument, I think there's no indication that the new statute in any way suggests that there is a way to get around the statutory requirements, you know, by filing a quiet title action. And, you know, I think, you know, what this court said in Garrity is the surface owner's failure to satisfy Division E, quote, precludes application of the DMA and renders unnecessary any further analysis. I mean, that's a clear statement of law that you have to follow the notice. You can't then just say, I'm going to file a quiet title to get around my failure to file a notice.
Excuse me. So that was kind of my point, because it's hard to see these as two separate methods. And frankly, if we just had this rote non-judicial method, the question of notice would be superfluous. And so the way that I saw these was actually two separate functions of an overall process to try to get to the truth of the matter in order to fairly clear the title.
I mean, we think it's required to get an abandonment after the 06 version to go through the statutory method. And what I would say is that the only event in which judicial review comes into play is if one of the party challenges the other party's actions under the statutory requirements. And I think a good example of that is in Dodd, you know, this court said presumably the surface owner can challenge the accuracy of the mineral interest holder's claim. If they file a claim to preserve, they could say, you know, hey, you don't own this, you know, you didn't, you know, whatever. And similarly, you know, as I did and as some other plaintiffs have done, you can challenge whether the statutory rights were met. But as they note, this is outside the operation of the Act. That's what the Dodd Court held. That's a judicial review of what happened within the Act. It's not a separate method. It's just a way to challenge, you know, whether or not the other party did what he was supposed to do or she was supposed to do. So, and again, there's a lot of discussion about Bays in appellant's brief. I guess I've read Bays too many times, and I still don't understand how it helps their position and why, you know, why overturning it. I mean, to me, Bays is basically Dodd's. The Bays court said that there's an absolute right to preserve. There was a claim to preserve filed, and the analysis in Bays is essentially a two-page recitation of key statements from Dodd about how claims to preserve work, and that if you file a claim to preserve, it doesn't matter whether there was a savings event. I mean, that's the holding of Dodd, if you timely file. And so what's interesting here is, you know, as we contend, we didn't get notice. My clients didn't get notice. But what we did before filing the complaint is we actually filed a claim to preserve. So we have a claim to preserve of record before they even decide to bring a quiet title action. Their quiet title action was filed, you know, months after we filed the claim to preserve. So, you know, how did we get around that? How did the defendants attempt to get around that? They claim that their attempt to follow the notice provisions, whether or not they served it, whether or not they received it, that starts the look-back period, just the act of doing it. And again, that's not what the statute says. The statute says that the 20-year look-back runs from service of notice under E, which to me means you actually satisfy the mandatory notice. You can't not have diligence and then use that to have a 20-year look-back period, deprive the holder of the right to file a claim to preserve, and then go into court and say they don't even have a right. But here, you know, we found out about it, we filed a claim to preserve, and, you know, under Dodd, the filing of a claim to preserve ends the case. It's determinative. You know, I think it's interesting because I think the way this court said it in Dodd, I thought was very apt, which is, you know, the court declined to rewrite the statute. They basically said this is an unambiguous statute, and to interpret it as the appellants contend would require the insertion of some language in B and the deletion of some language in E. And they said, we're not going to do that. And in our view, that's what the defendants are trying to do here. They want to say Division B says if the requirements of Division E are satisfied and no claim to preserve is filed, or, this is what they want inserted, or if the surface owners prove that no savings events have occurred in the prior 20 years through a subsequent quiet title action. Those words aren't there. It doesn't give them that option. Again, in our view, and what we how we see Dodd, you know, the right to file a claim to preserve is a key function of the statute. And what he's suggesting is a path that is not reflected in the language and deprives the holders of that right to file a claim to preserve. There's a lot of discussion about, is this fair and how this works? And, you know, I guess our initial response is that the language is the language. The legislature wrote it. They saw the decision in Dodd, which was 6 years ago. They could have amended it if they didn't think a claim to preserve can be filed, regardless of whether there's savings events. They didn't do that. And I think it's helpful to understand, you know, if you want to understand this as unfair, what did the holders or what did the surface owners used to have to do? They would have had to actually serve process and file a quiet title action and then prove that there was an intention to abandon. And, you know, as this court knows, that's a very difficult thing to prove, and many, many surface owners failed. Here, you know, many, many, many surface owners are successful because many times no one knows about these things. They can't find anyone. Maybe they rightfully file a notice to publication. But the idea that they're not getting lands is or interests is, I mean, the statute has shown that that's the case. But I think the way to think about the fairness of it is to understand that the whole presumed abandonment, that concept, deemed abandoned, is a stand-in for the common law. The common law, you had to prove intention. And all this statute is saying is, look, we're not going to make you jump through that hoop. If none of these things happen in the last 20 years and you serve notice the right way and the holder doesn't come forward and file a claim to preserve. But to me, that and is part of the protections. And it makes sense because as the Dodd court in the Seventh District, the appellate court said, you know, the law abhors a forfeiture, and we're going to, you know, the statute, we're going to interpret the statute to give a fair chance to these holders who reserve rights to preserve them. So a few more points just on some of the side issues. I think we briefed fairly extensively how we understood the Forfeiture Act and why we don't think they're parallel. They're sort of facially parallel. There's a few things, you know, the whole notice and filing of an affidavit are the same, but the key difference, and it's a difference that the defendants, you know, ignored in my view, is that the Forfeiture Act is clearly not intended to affect a termination. So ADMA affects an abandonment if you do certain things. It's a stand-in for the common law. The Forfeiture Act is, the lease is what governs whether there is a termination or expiration. And the Forfeiture Act allows you to put it on record. It doesn't cause the termination. The lease has already either terminated or expired under contract law. And either party is still permitted to go to court. You know, if you try to put that notice up there, the opposing party can go to court and file a quiet title and say, no, you know, this isn't expired or terminated because this is what the lease says. So in our view, they're very different statutes. You know, there's some argument about harmless error that was made, and that's the idea that even though they didn't comply with the notice provisions, that the error was harmless because we still had the ability to go into court and show savings events. And again, to me, that's a misunderstanding of the statute. It's not harmless because the right to get notice and to file a claim to preserve are fundamental under the 2006 ADMA. So it's a fundamental error not to give notice and to deny the holder the right to bring a claim to preserve. You know, I think an example of harmless error is the one noted, I think it was in Dodd, where it was found that they didn't follow the notice statute, but that the holder got notice nonetheless. They learned of it and filed the claim to preserve. So that was harmless because it didn't take away the holder's right to file a claim to preserve. They still had that right, and they still were able to effect it. Again, I've already addressed 2 and 3 in the process issues. You know, we think ultimately they don't matter to our case, but we think the 7th District got them right. I think I'd also like to say, you know, there's a few instances in this brief and more in our appellate argument in which the defendants say that we're advocating a whatever it takes stance as to searches. And we've never at one point through this whole litigation advocated a whatever it takes. We don't believe you have to keep looking and keep looking and keep looking. We agree with the 7th District and we agree with this court in Garrity that it's a reasonableness standard. It's not a bright line standard. If you know of information, you got to look for information.
If it's a reasonable standard and this case is on summary judgment, why isn't that a material fact issue?
Because it was unrebutted. In other words, the fact that the court made its decision on was not in dispute in any way, shape, or form. So that they knew that they resided in Washington County, Pennsylvania, and that they admitted that they knew it and that they made a decision not to look there. That was...
I understand. I'm just wondering, why wouldn't that at least go to the jury, whether that was reasonable or not? Generally, most reasonable questions go to the jury.
Yeah, I think that ultimately that's a decision of law that action, you know, that's completely unrebutted. It's not a question of fact. There is no, I mean, a question of fact would go to the jury as to whether or not they had certain information, to whether or not they acted on the information.
Whether it was reasonable, wouldn't that be a jury question?
I agree with the 7th District that it's per se unreasonable. If you have an obligation, if the goal of the statute is to find the person and the only good information you have is that the person was here and you decide to not look at all at that information and follow up on it, it's per se unreasonable.
They made a decision as a matter of law and reasonability.
Yes, they did. So I don't think I have anything else for the court. I would just, in closing, say that you know, in our view, that the defendants here failed to follow the terms of ADMA and the statute, and they're trying to circumvent those failures by filing a quiet title action, and that a quiet title action is not authorized by ADMA, and more importantly, it undercuts the requirements and protections contained unambiguously in the 2006 ADMA. And you know, we ask this court to affirm the 7th District, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Counsel?
Thank you. Just a few things. Rebuttal. So about the two methods of abandonment. Their position really is that the conclusive presumption, it used to exist, now it's gone. It's been merged out of existence. That means deemed abandoned means one thing over here, it means something else today. I think that the word should be given their same meaning. With regard to whether we satisfy the requirements, he keeps saying that, well, you don't think you have to satisfy the requirements of Division E. Yes, we do. We keep saying that over and over again, and we did that. We recorded the affidavit of abandonment, and we either served or published our notice.
Counsel, why didn't you go to Washington County, Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I mean, there's some discussion about that in the briefs. My partner who did the search, he saw the reference in the 1952 deed to the fact that they lived in Pennsylvania. In 2012, he did not believe that it was reasonably required for a landowner to try to search in Pennsylvania based on a reference that was however many decades old at that time.
Well, people don't necessarily move just because time has passed.
There's some people born in the state who lived here for decades.
Yeah, yeah, and but you know, at the time, he thought that if he was looking for a person who had an interest in his client's land located in Monroe County, that he should be able to find them in Monroe County.
Even though legal evidence demonstrated that he could find who he's looking for in Pennsylvania. Not saying Pennsylvania and its contiguous states. Didn't have to do New York, didn't have to do West Virginia, didn't have to go West Indiana, just the last state listed in the deed.
Well, I mean, that's true. It's only one state. Maybe you think that's not a big deal. What if you're looking for 10 people in 10 different states?
But that wasn't even just the state. The county was identified.
Yes.
Okay, so you're narrowing it even further by going to a neighboring state. It was, I believe, the reference was to the son of the decedent?
The reference was to the original record holder. It was to Elizabeth Fonzie, sure. Who reserved the interest in 1952.
Okay, so, you know, again, state identified, county identified. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, your partner thought, you know, 60 years later or so, probably not living there, so we're not even going to bother.
Well, not necessarily that they may not be living there, but that a landowner is not reasonably required to search for people in other states. That's what he thought at the time, and of course, there wasn't any case law. There's still no bright line rules about what you're supposed to do beyond searching in the records of the county where the property is located. So that was the decision that he made.
But. So you can just stick your head in the sand if you have this information and just do nothing?
No. I think you have to do a reasonably diligent search. He thought that that did not require him to go to Pennsylvania, as the courts have subsequently explained. Maybe that's not the case.
Well, but there's a difference between reasonably diligent and minimal diligence. I mean, certainly to search in Monroe County, in the state where the land is, but isn't that the minimal, isn't that the least amount that can be done, searching exactly where the land is located?
Well, and he did search in the county where the land is located. I'm not sure I would characterize that as the minimum. I mean, if you do a title search for land in any other context, I don't think you typically look for people in other states or other countries.
What about other counties? Within the state where the land is?
Well, I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that. That could be a fact issue that would need to be developed. And, you know, the mineral holders in this case, they were arguing that this was a fact issue on the appeal to the 7th District. And then when the court entered judgment in their favor as a matter of law, they don't think it's a fact issue anymore.
Well, counsel, the contents of the search were undisputed. Right, the search of Washington County. There was no dispute that was searchable, and there was pertinent information that was gotten through that search.
No, that is disputed, Your Honor. It's not disputed that there was a reference to Washington County, Pennsylvania, and Monroe County. It is disputed, however, whether or not if we had actually searched there, that we would have been able to identify the names and addresses of the mineral holders. They say that we could have, and we don't agree. We dispute that. And that is an issue that the 7th District did not address. And so we think
that... He still had the same last names. I mean, it wasn't like even a change of last name by marriage.
Mm-hmm.
It was... And there was an estate opened?
There was an estate opened for her ex-husband, who
correct.
Was not the mineral holder. And
he had dower rights. They were married when she got it.
Well, if you can have a dower right and a royalty interest, I guess he had dower rights. He didn't have dower rights after they got divorced. He didn't have dower rights after he died. And there's nothing in the estate that says anything about the record holder, Elizabeth Henthorne Fonzie.
And nobody knew they were divorced either.
Correct. Yeah, but there's no reference to her at all under her first married name or her second married. There's no reference to her whatsoever. There's two children identified in that estate, but it doesn't say whether they are the children of Elizabeth Henthorne Fonzi.
Sure, but it wasn't Smith. It wasn't Jones. It was F-O-N-Z-I. And the two people who are making their claims still have the same last name.
Yeah, but just because you have the same last name doesn't mean that you're related to Elizabeth Fonzi. If these are the children of Harry Fonzi, that means they're his children. They're not necessarily her children.
Sure, but the point being is that if there'd been a search, the names probably would have come up. And then you could figure out what to do from there.
Okay, but then you would have done something else, presumably. But that's an issue that wasn't addressed by the lower courts. And so we think that if you do think that's important, that it should be remanded for further proceedings on that issue. He said in his argument that we're trying to get around these requirements of Division E by just going to file a quiet title action. That's not true. We did not file a quiet title action. We didn't file this case. They filed it against us. Until my clients got sued in this case, they thought that they already had marketable record title to the mineral interest because they had done everything that was required of them under the statute. They had served the notice by publication. They had recorded their affidavit of abandonment. Nobody had responded, so they had indicated the abandonment in the records. The Forfeiture Act, he talked about the Forfeiture Act in his argument. I wanted to talk about that. We're not saying that the Forfeiture Act is exactly the same as the Dormant Mineral Act. What we're saying is that just because you have an extrajudicial process does not mean that that preempts any potential judicial action. That's his position. And the Forfeiture Act 5301.332 indicates that that is not the case.
But you told me there were two different methods.
Yes.
So you're saying one doesn't preclude the other, or you're saying that they operate together? What is it?
I'm saying that the first two requirements, the notice and the affidavit, are required under both, okay?
But the notice has to be adequate, correct?
The notice has to be served or published under Division B, okay? It has to be served or published. You have to do that, and we did. Okay, I mean, we published the notice in the newspaper. He's arguing about how it was served, whether it should have been mailed instead of published, but there's no dispute about whether there was a notice. And then in the extrajudicial process, it matters because there's a third step about whether they've responded or not. Okay, under Division B, there is no third requirement. It doesn't matter whether they have responded for under Division B. I also want to talk about what the Seventh District said about how they appear to us to be using the search requirement as a way of judging the sincerity of the landowners. We don't think that these lawsuits should be about whether the court thinks the landowners are good or bad. It shouldn't be invalidated simply because the former holder can accuse the landowner of acting in his own self-interest. There's nothing wrong with acting in your own self-interest. There's nothing wrong with trying to avail yourself of a statutory remedy and of trying to recover mineral rights under that statute. That's why the legislature enacted the statute in the first place. And there's only ever been three cases where mineral holders have prevailed under this statute. It's the Garrity, the Schultz, and the Sharp case. What happened in those three cases? There was a publication, nobody responded, then we have litigation over whether the search was adequate, and the court said, well, it was just good enough. So in those cases, the landowners were lucky because the court felt they found that sweet spot right in the middle where you search enough, but you don't search too much. And it's like the Goldilocks zone for search requirements. If you search too much, you will lose, okay? Because they will follow, if you mail it, they're gonna respond to it every single time. That's what happens. But we
so
don't think-
So are you saying the search is just a superficial activity and the goal is not to find people?
It is now, but that's not the way it's supposed to work. It is now, but we don't agree that it should be that way. Okay. We don't agree that you should be disincentivized from finding the person that you're supposed to be looking for. But I'll give you, I know I just have a little
Your
bit.
Your time is up.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We will take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.